then it would be difficult to generalize their behavior. It would also be difficult to project their behavior in time. In orthodox economics, rationality became a straitjacket. Platonified economists ignored the fact that people might prefer to do something other than maximize their economic interests. This led to mathematical techniques such as maximization or optimization, on which Paul Samuelson built much of his work. Optimization consists in finding the mathematically optimal policy that an economic agent could pursue. For instance, what is the optimal quantity you should allocate to stocks? It involves complicated mathematics and thus raises a barrier to entry by non-mathematically trained scholars. I would not be the first to say that this optimization set back social science by reducing it from the intellectual and reflective discipline that it was becoming to an attempt at an exact science. By exact science, I mean a second-rate engineering problem for those who want to pretend that they are in the physics department, so-called physics envy. In other words, an intellectual fraud. Optimization is a case of sterile modeling that we will discuss further in Chapter 17. It had no practical or even theoretical use, and so it became principally a competition for academic positions, a way to make people compete with mathematical muscle. It kept platonified economists out of the bars, solving equations at night. The tragedy is that Paul Samuelson, a quick mind, is said to be one of the most intelligent scholars of his generation. This was clearly a case of very badly invested intelligence. Characteristically, Samuelson intimidated those who questioned his techniques with the statement, "Those who can do science, others do methodology." If you knew math, you could do science. This is reminiscent of psychoanalysts who silence their critics by accusing them of having trouble with their fathers. Alas, it turns out that it was Samuelson and most of his followers who did not know much math, or did not know how to use what math they knew, how to apply it to reality. They only knew enough math to be blinded by it. Tragically, before the proliferation of empirically blind idiot savants, interesting work had been begun by true thinkers, the likes of J.M. Keynes, Friedrich Hayek, and the great Benoit Mandelbrot, all of whom were displaced because they moved economics away from the precision of second-rate physics. Very sad. One great underestimated thinker is G.L.S. Shackle, now almost completely obscure, who introduced the notion of unknowledge, that is, the unread books in Umberto Eco's library. It is unusual to see Shackle's work mentioned at all, and I had to buy his books from second-hand dealers in London. Legions of empirical psychologists of the heuristics and biases school have shown that the model of rational behavior under uncertainty is not just grossly inaccurate, but plain wrong as a description of reality. Their results also bother platonified economists because they reveal that there are several ways to be irrational. Tolstoy said that happy families were all alike, while each unhappy one is unhappy in its own way. People have been shown to make errors equivalent to preferring apples to oranges, oranges to pears, and pears to apples, depending on how the relevant questions are presented to them. The sequence matters. Also, as we have seen with the anchoring example, subjects' estimates of the number of dentists in Manhattan are influenced by which random number they have just been presented with, the anchor. Given the randomness of the anchor, we will have randomness in the estimates. So if people make inconsistent choices and decisions, the central core of economic optimization fails. You can no longer produce a general theory, and without one, you cannot predict. You have to learn to live without a general theory for Pluto's sake. The Grewness of Emerald. Recall the turkey problem. You look at the past and derive some rule about the future. Well, the problems in projecting from the past can be even worse than what we have already learned, because the same past data can confirm a theory and also its exact opposite. If you survive until tomorrow, it could mean that either A, you are more likely to be immortal, or B, that you are closer to death. Both conclusions rely on the exact same data. If you are a turkey being fed for a long period of time, you can either naively assume that feeding confirms your safety, or be shrewd and consider that it confirms the danger of being turned into supper. An acquaintance's unctuous past behavior may indicate his genuine affection for me and his concern for my welfare. It may also confirm his mercenary and calculating desire to get my business one day. So not only can the past be misleading, but there are also many degrees of freedom in our interpretation of past events. For the technical version of this idea, consider a series of dots on a page representing a number through time. See figures 3 through 6 in the PDF for a series of graphic models of patterns. Let's say your high school teacher asks you to extend the series of dots. With a linear model, that is, using a ruler, you can run only a straight line, a single straight line from the past to the future. The linear model is unique. There is one and only one straight line that can project from a series of points. But it can get trickier. If you do not limit yourself to a straight line, you find that there is a huge family of curves that can do the job of connecting the dots. If you project from the past in a linear way, you continue a trend, but possible future deviations from the course of the past are infinite. This is what the philosopher Nelson Goodman called the riddle of induction. We project a straight line only because we have a linear model in our head. The fact that a number has risen for 1,000 days straight should make you more confident that it will rise in the future. But if you have a non-linear model in your head, it might confirm that the number should decline on day 1,001. Let's say that you observe an emerald. It was green yesterday and the day before yesterday. It is green again today. Normally, this would confirm the green property. We can assume that the emerald will be green tomorrow. But to Goodman, the emerald's color history could equally confirm the GRU property. What is this GRU property? The emerald's GRU property is to be green until some specified date, say December 31, 2006, and then blue thereafter. The riddle of induction is another version of the narrative fallacy. You face an infinity of stories that explain what you have seen. The severity of Goodman's riddle of induction is as follows. If there is no longer even a single unique way to generalize from what you see, to make an inference about the unknown, then how should you operate? The answer clearly will be that you should employ common sense, but your common sense may not be so well developed with respect to some extremistan variables. That great anticipation machine. The listener is entitled to wonder, so NNT, why on earth do we plan? Some people do it for monetary gain, others because it's their job. But we also do it without such intentions, spontaneously. Why? The answer has to do with human nature. Planning may come with the package of what makes us human, namely our consciousness. There's supposed to be an evolutionary dimension to our need to project matters into the future, which I will rapidly summarize here, since it could be an excellent candidate explanation, an excellent conjecture, though, since it is linked to evolution, I would be cautious. The idea, as promoted by the philosopher Daniel Dennett, is as follows. What is the most potent use of our brain? It is precisely the ability to project conjectures into the future and play the counterfactual game. If I punch him in the nose, then he will punch me back right away, or worse, call his lawyer in New York. One of the advantages of doing so is that we can let our conjectures die in our stead. Used correctly and in place of more visceral reactions, the ability to project effectively frees us from immediate first-order natural selection, as opposed to more primitive organisms that were vulnerable to death and only grew by the improvement in the gene pool through the selection of the best. In a way, projecting allows us to cheat evolution. It now takes place in our head as a series of projections and counterfactual scenarios. This ability to mentally play with conjectures, even if it frees us from the laws of evolution, is itself supposed to be the product of evolution. It is as if evolution has put us on a long leash, whereas other animals live on the very short leash of immediate dependence on their environment. For Dennett, our brains are anticipation machines. For him, the human mind and consciousness are emerging properties, those properties necessary for our accelerated development. Why do we listen to experts and their forecasts? A candidate explanation is that society reposes on specialization, effectively the division of knowledge. You do not go to medical school the minute you encounter a big health problem. It is less taxing, and certainly safer, for you to consult someone who has already done so. Doctors listen to car mechanics, not for health matters, just when it comes to problems with their cars. Car mechanics listen to doctors. We have a natural tendency to listen to the expert, even in fields where there may be no experts. Chapter 12. Epistemocracy, a Dream. This is only an essay. Children and philosophers versus adults and non-philosophers. Science as an autistic enterprise. The past, too, has a past. Mispredict and live a long, happy life, if you survive. Someone with a low degree of epistemic arrogance is not too visible, like a shy person at a cocktail party. We are not predisposed to respect humble people, those who try to suspend judgment. Now contemplate epistemic humility. Think of someone heavily introspective, tortured by the awareness of his own ignorance. He lacks the courage of the idiot, yet has the rare guts to say, "I don't know." He does not mind looking like a fool or, worse, an ignoramus. He hesitates, he will not commit, and he agonizes over the consequences of being wrong. He introspects, introspects, and introspects until he reaches physical and nervous exhaustion. This does not necessarily mean that he lacks confidence, only that he holds his own knowledge to be suspect. I will call such a person an epistemocrat. The province where the laws are structured with this kind of human fallibility in mind, I will call the epistemocracy. The major modern epistemocrat is Montaigne. Monsieur de Montaigne, epistemocrat. At the age of 38, Michel Ecaim de Montaigne retired to his estate in the countryside of southwestern France. Montaigne, which means mountain in Old French, was the name of the estate. The area is known today for the Bordeaux wines, but in Montaigne's time, not many people invested their mental energy and sophistication in wine. Montaigne had stoic tendencies and would not have been strongly drawn to such pursuits anyway. His idea was to write a modest collection of attempts, that is, essays. The very word essay conveys the tentative, the speculative, and the non-definitive. Montaigne was well grounded in the classics and wanted to meditate on life, death, education, knowledge, and some not uninteresting biological aspects of human nature. He wondered, for example, whether cripples had more vigorous libidos owing to the richer circulation of blood in their sexual organs. The tower that became his study was inscribed with Greek and Latin sayings, almost all referring to the vulnerability of human knowledge. Its windows offered a wide vista of the surrounding hills. Montaigne's subject, officially, was himself, but this was mostly as a means to facilitate the discussion. He was not like those corporate executives who write biographies to make a boastful display of their honors and accomplishments. He was mainly interested in discovering things about himself, making us discover things about himself, and presenting matters that could be generalized, generalized to the entire human race. Among the inscriptions in his study was a remark by the Latin poet Terence, "Homo sum, humani ame nil alienum puto." I am a man, and nothing human is foreign to me. Montaigne is quite refreshing to read after the strains of a modern education, since he fully accepted human weaknesses and understood that no philosophy could be effective unless it took into account our deeply ingrained imperfections, the limitations of our rationality, the flaws that make us human. It is not that he was ahead of his time. It would be better said that later scholars, advocating rationality, were backward. He was a thinking, ruminating fellow, and his ideas did not spring up in his tranquil study, but while on horseback. He went on long rides and came back with ideas. Montaigne was neither one of the academics of the Sorbonne nor a professional man of letters. And he was not these things on two planes. First, he was a doer. He had been a magistrate, a businessman, and the mayor of Bordeaux before he retired to mull over his life and, mostly, his own knowledge. Second, he was an anti-dogmatist. He was a skeptic with charm, a fallible, non-committal, personal, introspective writer, and, primarily, someone who, in the great classical tradition, wanted to be a man. Had he been in a different period, he would have been an empirical skeptic. He had skeptical tendencies of the Pironian variety, the anti-dogmatic kind like Sextus Empiricus, particularly in his awareness of the need to suspend judgment. Epistemocracy. Everyone has an idea of utopia. For many, it means equality, universal justice, freedom from oppression, freedom from work. For some, it may be the more modest, though no more attainable, society with commuter trains, free of lawyers on cell phones. To me, utopia is an epistemocracy, a society in which anyone of rank is an epistemocrat, and where epistemocrats manage to be elected. It would be a society governed from the basis of the awareness of ignorance, not knowledge. Alas, one cannot assert authority by accepting one's own fallibility. Simply, people need to be blinded by knowledge. We are made to follow leaders who can gather people together because the advantages of being in groups trump the disadvantages of being alone. It has been more profitable for us to bind together in the wrong direction than to be alone in the right one. Those who have followed the assertive idiot rather than the introspective wise person have passed us some of their genes. This is apparent from a social pathology. Psychopaths rally followers. Once in a while you encounter members of the human species with so much intellectual superiority that they can change their minds effortlessly. Note here the following black swan asymmetry. I believe that you can be dead certain about some things, and ought to be so. You can be more confident about disconfirmation than confirmation. Karl Popper was accused of promoting self-doubt while writing in an aggressive and confident tone, an accusation that is occasionally addressed to this author by people who don't follow my logic of skeptical empiricism. Fortunately, we have learned a lot since Montaigne about how to carry on the skeptical empirical enterprise. The black swan asymmetry allows you to be confident about what is wrong, not about what you believe is right. Karl Popper was once asked whether one could falsify falsification, in other words, if one could be skeptical about skepticism. His answer was that he threw students out of his lectures for asking far more intelligent questions than that one. Quite tough, Sir Karl was. The past's past and the past's future. Some truths only hit children. Adults and non-philosophers get sucked into the minutiae of practical life and need to worry about serious matters, so they abandon these insights for seemingly more relevant questions. One of these truths concerns the larger difference in texture and quality between the past and the future. Thanks to my studying this distinction all my life, I understand it better than I did during my childhood, but I no longer envision it as vividly. The only way you can imagine a future similar to the past is by assuming that it will be an exact projection of it, hence predictable. Just as you know with some precision when you were born, you would then know with equal precision when you will die. The notion of future mixed with chance, not a deterministic extension of your perception of the past, is a mental operation that our mind cannot perform. Chance is too fuzzy for us to be a category by itself. There is an asymmetry between past and future, and it is too subtle for us to understand naturally. The first consequence of this asymmetry is that, in people's minds, the relationship between the past and the future does not learn from the relationship between the past and the past previous to it. There is a blind spot. When we think of tomorrow, we do not frame it in terms of what we thought about yesterday, on the day before yesterday. Because of this introspective defect, we fail to learn about the difference between our past predictions and the subsequent outcomes. When we think of tomorrow, we just project it as another yesterday. This small blind spot has other manifestations. Go to the primate section of the Bronx Zoo, where you can see our close relatives and the happy primate family leading their own busy social lives. You can also see masses of tourists laughing at the caricature of humans that the lower primates represent. Now imagine being a member of a higher level species, say a real philosopher, a truly wise person, far more sophisticated than the human primates. You would certainly laugh at the people laughing at the non-human primates. Clearly, to those people amused by the apes, the idea of a being who would look down on them the way they look down on the apes cannot immediately come to their minds. If it did, it would elicit self-pity. They would stop laughing. Accordingly, an element in the mechanics of how the human mind learns from the past makes us believe in definitive solutions, yet not consider that those who preceded us thought that they too had definitive solutions. We laugh at others, and we don't realize that someone will be just as justified in laughing at us on some not-too-remote day. Such a realization would entail the recursive or second-order thinking that I mentioned in the prologue. We are not good at it. This mental block about the future has not been investigated and labeled by psychologists, but it appears to resemble autism. Some autistic subjects can possess high levels of mathematical or technical intelligence. Their social skills are defective, but that is not the root of their problem. Autistic people cannot put themselves in the shoes of others, cannot view the world from their standpoint. They see others as inanimate objects, like machines, moved by explicit rules. They cannot perform such simple mental operations as, "He knows that I don't know that I know," and it is this inability that impedes their social skills. Interestingly, autistic subjects, regardless of their intelligence, also exhibit an inability to comprehend uncertainty. Just as autism is called mind blindness, this inability to think dynamically, to position oneself with respect to a future observer, we should call future blindness. Prediction, misprediction, and happiness. I searched the literature of cognitive science for any research on future blindness and found nothing. But in the literature on happiness, I did find an examination of our chronic errors in prediction that will make us happy. This prediction error works as follows. You are about to buy a new car. It is going to change your life, elevate your status, and make your commute a vacation. It is so quiet that you can hardly tell if the engine is on, so you can listen to Rachmaninoff's nocturnes on the highway. This new car will bring you to a permanently elevated plateau of contentment. People will think, "Hey, he has a great car," every time they see you. Yet you forget that the last time you bought a car, you also had the same expectations. You do not anticipate that the effect of the new car will eventually wane and that you will revert to the initial condition, as you did last time. A few weeks after you drive your new car out of the showroom, it will become dull. If you had expected this, you probably would not have bought it. You are about to commit a prediction error that you have already made, yet it would cost so little to introspect. Psychologists have studied this kind of misprediction with respect to both pleasant and unpleasant events. We overestimate the effects of both kinds of future events on our lives. We seem to be in a psychological predicament that makes us do so. This predicament is called Anticipated Utility by Danny Kahneman and Effective Forecasting by Dan Gilbert. The point is not so much that we tend to mispredict our future happiness, but rather that we do not learn recursively from past experiences. We have evidence of a mental block and distortions in the way we fail to learn from our past errors in projecting the future of our affective states. We grossly overestimate the length of the effect of misfortune on our lives. You think that the loss of your fortune or current position will be devastating, but you are probably wrong. More likely, you will adapt to anything, as you probably did after past misfortunes. You may feel a sting, but it will not be as bad as you expect. This kind of misprediction may have a purpose, to motivate us to perform important acts, like buying new cars or getting rich, and to prevent us from taking certain unnecessary risks. And it is part of a more general problem. We humans are supposed to fool ourselves a little bit here and there. According to Trivers' theory of self-deception, this is supposed to orient us favorably toward the future. But self-deception is not a desirable feature outside of its natural domain. It prevents us from taking some unnecessary risks, but we saw in Chapter 6 how it does not as readily cover a spate of modern risks that we do not fear because they are not vivid, such as investment risks, environmental dangers, or long-term security. Hellenes and the Reverse Prophecies. If you are in the business of being a seer, describing the future to other less privileged mortals, you are judged on the merits of your predictions. Hellenes in the Iliad was a different kind of seer. The son of Priam and Hecuba, he was the cleverest man in the Trojan army. It was he who, under torture, told the Achaeans how they would capture Troy. Apparently, he didn't predict that he himself would be captured. But this is not what distinguished him. Hellenes, unlike other seers, was able to predict the past with great precision, without having been given any details of it. He predicted backward. Our problem is not just that we do not know the future. We do not know much of the past, either. We badly need someone like Hellenes if we are to know history. Let us see how. The Melting Ice Cube. Consider the following thought experiment borrowed from my friends Aaron Brown and Paul Wilmot. Operation 1, the Melting Ice Cube. Imagine an ice cube and consider how it may melt over the next 2 hours while you play a few rounds of poker with your friends. Try to envision the shape of the resulting puddle. Operation 2, where did the water come from? Consider a puddle of water on the floor. Now try to reconstruct in your mind's eye the shape of the ice cube it may once have been. Note that the puddle may not have necessarily originated from an ice cube. The second operation is harder. Hellenes indeed had to have skills. The difference between these two processes resides in the following. If you have the right models and some time on your hands and nothing better to do, you can predict with great precision how the ice cube will melt. This is a specific engineering problem devoid of complexity, easier than the one involving billiard balls. However, from the pool of water you can build infinite possible ice cubes, if there was in fact an ice cube there at all. The first direction, from the ice cube to the puddle, is called the forward process. The second direction, the backward process, is much, much more complicated. The forward process is generally used in physics and engineering. The backward process in non-repeatable, non-experimental historical approaches. In a way, the limitations that prevent us from unfrying an egg also prevent us from reverse engineering history. Now, let me increase the complexity of the forward-backward problem just a bit by assuming non-linearity. Take what is generally called the butterfly in India paradigm from the discussion of Lorenz's discovery in the previous chapter. As we have seen, a small input in a complex system can lead to non-random large results, depending on very special conditions. A single butterfly flapping its wings in New Delhi may be the certain cause of a hurricane in North Carolina, though the hurricane may take place a couple of years later. However, given the observation of a hurricane in North Carolina, it is dubious that you could figure out the causes with any precision. There are billions and billions of such small things as wing-flapping butterflies in Timbuktu or sneezing wild dogs in Australia that could have caused it. The process from the butterfly to the hurricane is greatly simpler than the reverse process from the hurricane to the potential butterfly. Confusion between the two is disastrously widespread in common culture. This butterfly in India metaphor has fooled at least one filmmaker. For instance, Happenstance, a.k.a. The Beating of a Butterfly's Wings, a French-language film by one Laurent Firaud, meant to encourage people to focus on small things that can change the course of their lives. Hey, since a small event, a petal falling on the ground and getting your attention, can lead to your choosing one person over another as a mate for life, you should focus on these very small details. Neither the filmmaker nor the critics realized that they were dealing with a backward process. There are trillions of such small things in the course of a simple day, and examining all of them lies outside of our reach. Once again, incomplete information. Take a personal computer. You can use a spreadsheet program to generate a random sequence, a succession of points we can call a history. How? The computer program responds to a very complicated equation of a non-linear nature that produces numbers that seem random. The equation is very simple. If you know it, you can predict the sequence. It is almost impossible, however, for a human being to reverse engineer the equation and predict further sequences. I am talking about a simple one-line computer program called the tent map, generating a handful of data points, not about the billions of simultaneous events that constitute the real history of the world. In other words, even if history were a non-random series generated by some equation of the world, as long as reverse engineering such an equation does not seem within human possibility, it should be deemed random and not bear the name deterministic chaos. Historians should stay away from chaos theory and the difficulties of reverse engineering except to discuss general properties of the world and learn the limits of what they can't know. This brings me to a greater problem with the historian's craft. I will state the fundamental problem of practice as follows. While in theory randomness is an intrinsic property, in practice, randomness is incomplete information, what I called opacity in Chapter 1. Non-practitioners of randomness do not understand the subtlety. Often, in conferences when they hear me talk about uncertainty and randomness, philosophers, and sometimes mathematicians, bug me about the least relevant point, namely whether the randomness I address is true randomness or deterministic chaos that masquerades as randomness. A true random system is in fact random and does not have predictable properties. A chaotic system has entirely predictable properties, but they are hard to know. So my answer to them is dual. A. There is no functional difference in practice between the two, since we will never get to make the distinction. The difference is mathematical, not practical. If I see a pregnant woman, the sex of her child is a purely random matter to me, a 50% chance for either sex, but not to her doctor, who might have done an ultrasound. In practice, randomness is fundamentally incomplete information. B. The mere fact that a person is talking about the difference implies that he has never made a meaningful decision under uncertainty, which is why he does not realize that they are indistinguishable in practice. Randomness, in the end, is just unknowledge. The world is opaque, and appearances fool us. What they call knowledge. One final word on history. History is like a museum where one can go to see the repository of the past and taste the charm of olden days. It is a wonderful mirror in which we can see our own narratives. You can even track the past using DNA analyses. I am fond of literary history. Ancient history satisfies my desire to build my own self-narrative, my identity, to connect with my complicated Eastern Mediterranean roots. I even prefer the accounts of older, patently less accurate books to modern ones. Among the authors I've reread, the ultimate test of whether you like an author is if you've reread him. The following come to mind: Plutarch, Livy, Suetonius, Diodorus Siculus, Gibbon, Carlyle, Renan, and Michelet. These accounts are patently substandard compared to today's works. They are largely anecdotal and full of myths. But I know this. History is useful for the thrill of knowing the past, and for the narrative, indeed, provided it remains a harmless narrative. One should learn under severe caution. History is certainly not a place to theorize or derive general knowledge, nor is it meant to help in the future without some caution. We can get negative confirmation from history, which is invaluable, but we get plenty of illusions of knowledge along with it. This brings me back once again to Monodotus and the treatment of the turkey problem and how to not be a sucker for the past. The empirical doctor's approach to the problem of induction was to know history without theorizing from it. Learn to read history, get all the knowledge you can, do not frown on the anecdote, but do not draw any causal links, do not try to reverse engineer too much, but if you do, do not make big scientific claims. Remember that the empirical skeptics had respect for custom. They used it as a default, a basis for action, but not for more than that. This clean approach to the past they called epilogism. Footnote: Yogi Berra might have a theory of epilogism with his saying, "You can observe a lot by just watching." But most historians have another opinion. consider the representative introspection What is History? By Edward Hallett Carr. You will catch him explicitly pursuing causation as a central aspect of his job. You can even go higher up. Herodotus, deemed to be the father of the subject, defined his purpose in the opening of his work. To preserve a memory of the deeds of the Greeks and barbarians, and in particular, beyond everything else, to give a cause to their fighting one another. You see the same with all theoreticians of history, whether Ibn Khaldun, Marx, or Hegel. The more we try to turn history into anything other than an enumeration of accounts to be enjoyed with minimal theorizing, the more we get into trouble. Are we so plagued with a narrative fallacy? Footnote. While looking at the past, it would be a good idea to resist naive analogies. Many people have compared the United States today to ancient Rome, both from a military standpoint. The destruction of Carthage was often invoked as an incentive for the destruction of enemy regimes, and from a social one, the endless platitudinous warnings of the upcoming decline and fall. Alas, we need to be extremely careful in transposing knowledge from a simple environment that is closer to type 1, like the one we had in antiquity, to today's type 2 complex system, with its intricate webs of causal links. Another error is to draw causal conclusions from the absence of nuclear war, since, invoking the Casanova argument of Chapter 8, I would repeat that we would not be here had a nuclear war taken place, and it is not a good idea for us to derive a cause when our survival is conditioned on that cause. We may have to wait for a generation of skeptical empiricist historians capable of understanding the difference between a forward process and a reverse one. Just as Popper attacked the historicists in their making claims about the future, I have just presented the weakness of the historical approach in knowing the past itself. After this discussion about future and past blindness, let us see what to do about it. Remarkably, there are extremely practical measures we can take. We will explore this next. Chapter 13. Apelles the Painter, or What Do You Do If You Cannot Predict? Footnote. This chapter provides a general conclusion for those who by now say, Taleb, I get the point, but what should I do? My answer is that if you got the point, you are pretty much there. But here is a nudge. You should charge people for advice. My two cents here. Nobody knows anything, but, at least, he knows it. Go to parties. Advice is cheap, very cheap. It is not a good habit to stuff one's text with quotations from prominent thinkers, except to make fun of them or provide a historical reference. They make sense, but well-sounding maxims force themselves on our gullibility and do not always stand up to empirical tests. So I chose the following statement by the uber-philosopher Bertrand Russell precisely because I disagree with it. The demand for certainty is one which is natural to man, but is nevertheless an intellectual vice. If you take your children for a picnic on a doubtful day, they will demand a dogmatic answer as to whether it will be fine or wet, and be disappointed in you when you cannot be sure. But so long as men are not trained to withhold judgment in the absence of evidence, they will be led astray by cocksure prophets. For the learning of every virtue there is an appropriate discipline, and for the learning of suspended judgment the best discipline is philosophy. The listener may be surprised that I disagree. It is hard to disagree that the demand for certainty is an intellectual vice. It is hard to disagree that we can be led astray by some cocksure prophet. Where I beg to differ with the great man is that I do not believe in the track record of advice-giving philosophy in helping us deal with the problem, nor do I believe that virtues can be easily taught, nor do I urge people to strain in order to avoid making a judgment. Why? Because we have to deal with humans as humans. We cannot teach people to withhold judgment. Judgments are embedded in the way we view objects. I do not see a tree. I see a pleasant or an ugly tree. It is not possible without great, paralyzing effort to strip these small values we attach to matters. Likewise, It is not possible to hold a situation in one's head without some element of bias. Something in our dear human nature makes us want to believe. So what? Philosophers since Aristotle have taught us that we are deep-thinking animals, and that we can learn by reasoning. It took a while to discover that we do effectively think, but that we more readily narrate backward in order to give ourselves the illusion of understanding, and to give a cover to our past actions. The minute we forgot about this point, the Enlightenment came to drill it into our heads for a second time. I'd rather degrade us humans to a level certainly above other known animals, but not quite on a par with the ideal Olympian man who can absorb philosophical statements and act accordingly. Indeed, if philosophy were that effective, the self-help section of the local bookstore would be of some use in consoling souls experiencing pain, but it isn't. We forget to philosophize when under strain. I'll end this section on prediction with the following two lessons, one very brief for the small matters, one rather lengthy for the large, important decisions. Being a fool in the right places. The lesson for the small is, be human, except that being human involves some amount of epistemic arrogance in running your affairs. Do not be ashamed of that. Do not try to always withhold judgment. Opinions are the stuff of life. Do not try to avoid predicting. Yes, after this diatribe about prediction, I am not urging you to stop being a fool. Just be a fool in the right places. Footnote. Dan Gilbert showed in a famous paper, How Mental Systems Believe, that we are not natural skeptics and that not believing required an expenditure of mental effort. What you should avoid is unnecessary dependence on large-scale harmful predictions. Those, and only those. Avoid the big subjects that may hurt your future. Be fooled in small matters, not in the large. Do not listen to economic forecasters or to predictors in social science. They are mere entertainers. But do make your own forecast for the picnic. By all means, demand certainty for the next picnic. But avoid government social security forecasts for the year 2040. Know how to rank beliefs not according to their plausibility, but by the harm they may cause. Be prepared. The reader might feel queasy reading about these general failures to see the future and wonder what to do. But if you shed the idea of full predictability, there are plenty of things to do, provided you remain conscious of their limits. Knowing that you cannot predict does not mean that you cannot benefit from unpredictability. The bottom line, be prepared. Narrow-minded prediction has an analgesic or therapeutic effect. Be aware of the numbing effect of magic numbers. Be prepared for all relevant eventualities. The idea of positive accident. Recall the empirics, those members of the Greek school of empirical medicine. They considered that you should be open-minded in your medical diagnoses to let luck play a role. By luck, a patient might be cured, say, by eating some food that accidentally turns out to be the cure for his disease, so that the treatment can then be used on subsequent patients. The positive accident, like hypertension medicine producing side benefits that led to Viagra, was the empiric's central method of medical discovery. This same point can be generalized to life. Maximize the serendipity around you. Sextus Empiricus retold the story of Apelles the painter, who, while doing a portrait of a horse, was attempting to depict the foam from the horse's mouth. After trying very hard and making a mess, he gave up and, in irritation, took the sponge he used for cleaning his brush and threw it at the picture. Where the sponge hit, it left a perfect representation of the foam. Trial and error means trying a lot. In The Blind Watchmaker, Richard Dawkins brilliantly illustrates this notion of the world without grand design, moving by small, incremental, random changes. Note a slight disagreement on my part that does not change the story by much. The world, rather, moves by large, incremental, random changes. Indeed, we have psychological and intellectual difficulties with trial and error, and with accepting that a series of small failures are necessary in life. My colleague Mark Spitznagel understood that we humans have a mental hang-up about failures. "You need to love to lose," was his motto. In fact, the reason I felt immediately at home in America is precisely because American culture encourages the process of failure, unlike the cultures of Europe and Asia, where failure is met with stigma and embarrassment. America's specialty is to take these small risks for the rest of the world, which explains this country's disproportionate share in innovations. Once established, an idea or a product is later perfected over there. Volatility and risk of black swan. People are often ashamed of losses, so they engage in strategies that produce very little volatility but contain the risk of a large loss, like collecting nickels in front of steamrollers. In Japanese culture, which is ill-adapted to randomness and badly equipped to understand that bad performance can come from bad luck, losses can severely tarnish someone's reputation. People hate volatility, thus engage in strategies exposed to blow-ups, leading to occasional suicides after a big loss. Furthermore, this trade-off between volatility and risk can show up in careers that give the appearance of being stable, like jobs at IBM until the 1990s. When laid off, the employee faces a total void. He is no longer fit for anything else. The same holds for those in protected industries. On the other hand, consultants can have volatile earnings as their clients' earnings go up and down, but face a lower risk of starvation, since their skills match demand. Fluctuat nec mergitur, fluctuates but doesn't sink. Likewise, dictatorships that do not appear volatile, like, say, Syria or Saudi Arabia, face a larger risk of chaos than, say, Italy, as the latter has been in a state of continual political turmoil since the Second War. I learned about this problem from the finance industry, in which we see conservative bankers sitting on a pile of dynamite, but fooling themselves because their operations seem dull and lacking in volatility. Barbell strategy. I am trying here to generalize to real life the notion of the barbell strategy I used as a trader, which is as follows. If you know that you are vulnerable to prediction errors, and if you accept that most risk measures are flawed because of the black swan, then your strategy is to be as hyper-conservative and hyper-aggressive as you can, instead of being mildly aggressive or conservative. Instead of putting your money in medium-risk investments, how do you know it is medium-risk? By listening to tenure-seeking experts? You need to put a portion, say 85 to 90%, in extremely safe instruments, like treasury bills, as safe a class of instruments as you can manage to find on this planet. The remaining 10 to 15% you put in extremely speculative bets, as leveraged as possible, like options, preferably venture capital-style portfolios. Footnote: make sure that you have plenty of these small bets. Avoid being blinded by the vividness of one single black swan. Have as many of these small bets as you can conceivably have. Even venture capital firms fall for the narrative fallacy with a few stories that make sense to them. They do not have as many bets as they should. If venture capital firms are profitable, it is not because of the stories they have in their heads, but because they are exposed to unplanned rare events. That way, you do not depend on errors of risk management. No black swan can hurt you at all, beyond your floor, the nest egg that you have in maximally safe investments. Or, equivalently, you can have a speculative portfolio and insure it, if possible, against losses of more than, say, 15%. You are clipping your incomputable risk, the one that is harmful to you. Instead of having medium risk, you have high risk on one side and no risk on the other. The average will be medium risk, but constitutes a positive exposure to the black swan. More technically, this can be called a convex combination. Let us see how this can be implemented in all aspects of life. Nobody knows anything. The legendary screenwriter William Goldman was said to have shouted, "Nobody knows anything," in relation to the prediction of movie sales. Now, the reader may wonder how someone as successful as Goldman can figure out what to do without making predictions. The answer stands perceived business logic on its head. He knew that he could not predict individual events, but he was well aware that the unpredictable, namely a movie turning into a blockbuster, would benefit him immensely. So the second lesson is more aggressive. You can actually take advantage of the problem of prediction and epistemic arrogance. As a matter of fact, I suspect that the most successful businesses are precisely those that know how to work around inherent unpredictability and even exploit it. Recall my discussion of the biotech company whose managers understood that the essence of research is in the unknown unknowns. Also, notice how they seized on the corners, those free lottery tickets in the world. Here are the modest tricks, but note that the more modest they are, the more effective they will be. A. First, make a distinction between positive contingencies and negative ones. Learn to distinguish between those human undertakings in which the lack of predictability can be, or has been, extremely beneficial, and those where the failure to understand the future caused harm. There are both positive and negative black swans. William Goldman was involved in the movies, a positive black swan business. Uncertainty did occasionally pay off there. A negative black swan business is one where the unexpected can hit hard and hurt severely. If you are in the military, in catastrophe insurance, or in homeland security, you face only downside. Likewise, as we saw in Chapter 7, if you are in banking and lending, surprise outcomes are likely to be negative for you. You lend, and in the best of circumstances you get your loan back. But you may lose all of your money if the borrower defaults. In the event that the borrower enjoys great financial success, he is not likely to offer you an additional dividend. Aside from the movies, examples of positive black swan businesses are some segments of publishing, scientific research, and venture capital. In these businesses, you lose small to make big. You have little to lose per book, and for completely unexpected reasons, any given book might take off. The downside is small and easily controlled. The problem with publishers, of course, is that they regularly pay up for books, thus making their upside rather limited and their downside monstrous. If you pay $10 million for a book, your black swan is it not being a bestseller. Likewise, while technology can carry a great payoff, paying for the hyped-up story, as people did with the dot-com bubble, can make any upside limited and any downside huge. It is the venture capitalist who invested in the speculative company and sold his stake to unimaginative investors who is the beneficiary of the black swan, not the Me Too investors. In these businesses, you are lucky if you don't know anything, particularly if others don't know anything either, but aren't aware of it. And you fare best if you know where your ignorance lies, if you are the only one looking at the unread books, so to speak. This dovetails into the barbell strategy of taking maximum exposure to the positive black swans while remaining paranoid about the negative ones. For your exposure to the positive black swan, you do not need to have any precise understanding of the structure of uncertainty. I find it hard to explain that when you have a very limited loss, you need to get as aggressive, as speculative, and sometimes as unreasonable as you can be. Middlebrow thinkers sometimes make the analogy of such strategy with that of collecting lottery tickets. It is plain wrong. First, lottery tickets do not have a scalable payoff. There is a known upper limit to what they can deliver. The Ludic fallacy applies here. The scalability of real-life payoffs compared to lottery ones makes the payoff unlimited or of unknown limit. Secondly, the lottery tickets have known rules and laboratory-style well-presented possibilities. Here we do not know the rules and can benefit from this additional uncertainty, since it cannot hurt you and can only benefit you. Footnote. There is a finer epistemological point. Remember that in a virtuous black swan business, what the past did not reveal is almost certainly going to be good for you. When you look at past biotech revenues, you do not see the super blockbuster in them, and owing to the potential for a cure for cancer or headaches, or baldness, or bad sense of humor, etc., there is a small probability that the sales in that industry may turn out to be monstrous, far larger than might be expected. On the other hand, consider negative black swan businesses. The track record you see is likely to overestimate the properties. Recall the 1982 blow-up of banks. They appeared to the naive observer to be more profitable than they seemed. Insurance companies are of two kinds, the regular diversifiable kind that belongs to mediocristan, say, life insurance, and the more critical and explosive black swan-prone risks that are usually sold to reinsurers. According to the data, reinsurers have lost money on underwriting over the past couple of decades, but, unlike bankers, they are introspective enough to know that it actually could have been far worse because the past 20 years did not have a big catastrophe, and all you need is one of those per century to kiss the business goodbye. Many finance academics doing valuation on insurance seem to have missed the point. B. Don't look for the precise and the local. Simply, do not be narrow-minded. The great discoverer Pasteur, who came up with the notion that chance favors the prepared, understood that you do not look for something particular every morning, but work hard to let contingency enter your working life. As Yogi Berra, another great thinker, said, "You got to be very careful if you don't know where you're going, because you might not get there." Likewise, do not try to predict precise black swans. It tends to make you more vulnerable to the ones you did not predict. My friends Andy Marshall and Andrew Mays at the Department of Defense face the same problem. The impulse on the part of the military is to devote resources to predicting the next problems. These thinkers advocate the opposite. Invest in preparedness, not in prediction. Remember that infinite vigilance is just not possible. C. Seize any opportunity or anything that looks like opportunity. They are rare, much rarer than you think. Remember that positive black swans have a necessary first step. You need to be exposed to them. Many people do not realize that they are getting a lucky break in life when they get it. If a big publisher, or a big art dealer, or a movie executive, or a hotshot banker, or a big thinker suggests an appointment, cancel anything you have planned. You may never see such a window open up again. I am sometimes shocked at how little people realize that these opportunities do not grow on trees. Collect as many free non-lottery tickets, those with open-ended payoffs, as you can, and, once they start paying off, do not discard them. Work hard, not in grunt work, but in chasing such opportunities and maximizing exposure to them. This makes living in big cities invaluable because you increase the odds of serendipitous encounters. You gain exposure to the envelope of serendipity. The idea of settling in a rural area on grounds that one has good communications in the age of the Internet tunnels out of such sources of positive uncertainty. Diplomats understand that very well. Casual chance discussions at cocktail parties usually lead to big breakthroughs, not dry correspondence or telephone conversations. Go to parties. If you're a scientist, you will chance upon a remark that might spark new research. And if you are autistic, send your associates to these events. D. Beware of precise plans by governments. As discussed in Chapter 10, let governments predict. It makes officials feel better about themselves and justifies their existence, but do not set much store by what they say. Remember that the interest of these civil servants is to survive and self-perpetuate, not to get to the truth. It does not mean that governments are useless, only that you need to keep a vigilant eye on their side effects. For instance, regulators in the banking business are prone to a severe expert problem, and they tend to condone reckless but hidden risk-taking. Andy Marshall and Andy Mays asked me if the private sector could do better in predicting. Alas, no. Once again, recall the story of banks hiding explosive risks in their portfolios. It is not a good idea to trust corporations with matters such as rare events, because the performance of these executives is not observable on a short-term basis, and they will game the system by showing good performance so they can get their yearly bonus. The Achilles heel of capitalism is that if you make corporations compete, it is sometimes the one that is most exposed to the negative black swan that will appear to be the most fit for survival. Also recall from the footnote on Ferguson's discovery in Chapter 1 that markets are not good predictors of wars. No one in particular is a good predictor of anything. Sorry. E. There are some people who, if you don't already know, you can't tell them. As the great philosopher of uncertainty Yogi Berra once said, do not waste your time trying to fight forecasters, stock analysts, economists, and social scientists except to play pranks on them. They are considerably easy to make fun of, and many get angry quite readily. It is ineffective to moan about unpredictability. People will continue to predict foolishly, especially if they are paid for it, and you cannot put an end to institutionalized frauds. If you ever do have to heed a forecast, keep in mind that its accuracy degrades rapidly as you extend it through time. If you hear a prominent economist using the word equilibrium or normal distribution, do not argue with him. Just ignore him, or try to put a rat down his shirt. The Great Asymmetry. All these recommendations have one point in common, asymmetry. Put yourself in situations where favorable consequences are much larger than unfavorable ones. Indeed, the notion of asymmetric outcomes is the central idea of this book. I will never get to know the unknown, since, by definition, it is unknown. However, I can always guess how it might affect me, and I should base my decisions around that. This idea is often erroneously called Pascal's wager, after the philosopher and thinking mathematician Blaise Pascal. He presented it something like this: I do not know whether God exists, but I know that I have nothing to gain from being an atheist if he does not exist, whereas I have plenty to lose if he does. Hence, this justifies my belief in God. Pascal's argument is severely flawed theologically. One has to be naive enough to believe that God would not penalize us for false belief, unless, of course, one is taking the quite restrictive view of a naive God. Bertrand Russell was reported to have claimed that God would need to have created fools for Pascal's argument to work. But the idea behind Pascal's wager has fundamental applications outside of theology. It stands the entire notion of knowledge on its head. It eliminates the need for us to understand the probabilities of a rare event. There are fundamental limits to our knowledge of these. Rather, we can focus on the payoff and benefits of an event if it takes place. The probabilities of very rare events are not computable. The effect of an event on us is considerably easier to ascertain. The rarer the event, the fuzzier the odds. We can have a clear idea of the consequences of an event, even if we do not know how likely it is to occur. I don't know the odds of an earthquake, but I can imagine how San Francisco might be affected by one. This idea that in order to make a decision you need to focus on the consequences, which you can know, rather than the probability, which you can't know, is the central idea of uncertainty. Much of my life is based on it. You can build an overall theory of decision.